It's Wednesday, December 15, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Yesterday's edition of The Wall Street Journal included a very interesting editorial. In the editorial, the Journal credits the New York Times, its main competitor paper, for its news coverage of the Christians who are fleeing Iraq in the wake of oppression. In the editorial statement, The Wall Street Journal says that these Christian minorities are leaving in order to avoid bloodshed and, as they write, a spate of anti-Christian bombings and assassinations in Iraq culminated recently in the siege of a church when at least 51 worshipers and two priests were killed. Now, the way the editorial ends is what is particularly interesting. It ends with this paragraph. Living amid an overwhelmingly large majority, the small Christian sects pose no conceivable threat to Islamic hegemony. One can only conclude that they are attacked merely because they exist amid Islamic majorities. The implications of watching a strain of Islam show that it cannot coexist with others extend well beyond the borders of Iraq. End quote. In other words, the oppression of these Christians in Iraq, the very fact that these Christian minorities are being pushed out of the nation by its Islamic majority, is a test case not only for Iraq, but for the entire Muslim world. If Christians cannot be tolerated when they pose absolutely no threat to the Islamic majority, then what then are we to make of the prospects of an Islamic rule in much of the world and the prospects for Christianity in terms of that Muslim hegemony? At this point, we must ask the question that not even the editors of the Wall Street Journal dared to ask. Where are the Muslims in the West in terms of condemning this reality in Iraq? Where are the Muslims in America in terms of arguing that what is going on in Iraq is not indeed a representation of Islam, but of something that is sinister and needs to be condemned? It'll be fascinating to see if such voices arise. Nevertheless, given our experience over the past several years, I doubt those voices will arise. And that should tell us just about everything we need to know about just how Muslims do see the issue of Christianity in their midst. Remember that it is not only illegal to bear witness to the gospel in many Muslim lands, it is a capital crime to convert to Christianity or to be the agent of anyone else's conversion. Those are indeed sobering thoughts. I'm thankful for the editorial in the Wall Street Journal, and I found it interesting that the journal credited the New York Times for its very considerable news story published over the weekend. In recent years, the Wall Street Journal, owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, has moved into a position of direct competition with the New York Times, even in coverage of matters of metropolitan New York and Manhattan. In the New York City edition of the Wall Street Journal, there is a special New York section. For the first time, the New York Times has a competitor in the Wall Street Journal going head-to-head for local coverage. You may think that the age of the newspaper is dead, but just look to a city like New York and you'll discover that the newspaper is anything but dead, even in its print edition. The big question for the future of the newspaper is not so much in a city like New York. It's about the rest of the country, at least for now. A news story out of Kosovo should have our attention today, as Kosovo's Prime Minister Hashim Thaci is accused of heading an organ-stealing ring and turning a small nation into a bastion of organized crime. The Council of Europe has alerted the rest of the world to this report, and legal proceedings have begun in a Pristina district there in Kosovo into a case of alleged organ trafficking, which was discovered by police back in 2008. What makes this particularly frightening is that it involves the Kosovo Liberation Army, or the KLA, which is accused of taking organs from Serb prisoners. The Serbian prisoners taken in the midst of Kosovo's War of Independence, and the organs sold on the world market for literally millions of dollars in cumulative sales. Now, this court case is going to be making its way through the European courts, but we should note even at this point that there is an international market in black market organs, stolen organs. There have been reports of organs taken from prisoners in China, of organs taken from kidnapped persons in much of the world and in the Pacific Rim, of organs taken from the poor in some of the most depressed areas of the world, and now organs taken from prisoners of war in Kosovo. Given the dynamic of supply and demand, there is an enormous black market internationally for human cells, human tissues, human blood, human organs for transplant, and now even human gametes, sperm and eggs. We're living in the brave new world that previous generations worried about. The reality is that we have a wild, wild west with virtually no legal authority able to bring a coherent policy or a moral approach to the regulation and enforcement of laws. The late Clark Kerr, formerly chancellor of the university system in California, said, and I find this one of my favorite academic quotations, that the reason so many academic debates are so hot is because the stakes are so low. If you need an illustration of that, consider a couple of recent issues of the New York Times, where reporter Nicholas Wade has been telling us about a debate within the field of anthropology. Just a few days ago, this would be last Friday, he ran a major news story with the headline, "Anthropology a Science? The Experts Disagree." Has to do with the fact that the Society of Anthropologists has decided that it would take the word science out of its long-range plan, where it appeared three times. The American Anthropological Association, in preparation for its recent meeting in New York City, removed the word science because a good many, indeed many now argue a majority of anthropologists, say that what they're doing is not science. Without any hesitation or professional embarrassment, these anthropologists argue that what they're really doing is studying race, ethnicity, gender, and different human aspects in order to be advocates for Native peoples or for human rights for particular populations. Now, when you look at this debate, it really is interesting because it comes down to the word science. Science is a privileged word in our society. To identify as a scientist is to, at least in theory, obligate oneself to certain intellectual habits, to certain constraints, to an empirical method of observation and research, to peer-reviewed publications, and all the rest. Well, when it comes to the advocacy role that so many anthropologists now want, the world of science simply is too constraining. So we need to recognize a basic honesty in the fact that the American Anthropological Association had decided to take the word science out. Well, that was on Friday. In yesterday's edition of the Times, Mr. Wade reports that the American Anthropological Association has decided it needed to smooth over differences between its two warring factions. It didn't put the word science back in the long-range planning document. Instead, it has put the word science in terms of a statement that recognizes, quote, "the crucial place of the scientific method in much anthropological research," end quote. Now, if you're looking at this, you'll note this is basically a surrender of the scientific side or branch of modern anthropology. It's something of a political negotiation between these two warring branches in order that the American Anthropological Association can have at least the facade of a united front. But it does indicate, as if we needed this kind of confirmation, that so many of these fields have become so overtly politicized that there are many who are at least honest enough to say that advocacy is their primary role, not phenomenological, empirical, unbiased research. That's something of an honest acknowledgement for which we should be thankful. But the debate goes on. One evolutionary anthropologist quoted in the article said this, "We evolutionary anthropologists are outnumbered by the new cultural or social anthropologists, many but not all of whom are postmodern, which seems to translate into anti-science," end quote. Something tells me this controversy is going to come up again at their next meeting, but even if it does not, this affirms the politicized nature of so many of the academic disciplines. Keep that in mind when you consider what's going on at your local college or university. The arrest last week in New York of Columbia University political scientist David Epstein has set off a controversy many of us would simply wish never to have to discuss. Mr. Epstein was arrested on a single felony count of criminal incest, and that arrest has set off a massive moral controversy that has been largely ignored by many of the mainstream media outlets, but has worked its way into a truly interesting conversation in terms of the larger culture. Now, at my website at albertmoeller.com, I published an article this morning entitled, "So Why Is Incest Wrong?" But you also want to be looking at an article by William Salatin at slate.com. Salatin is one of the most relevant writers right now on the issues of biomedical ethics and human nature. I often find myself in disagreement with him, but I'm always impressed by the candor of his arguments. Mr. Epstein was arrested and charged with having a consensual sexual relationship over several years with his own biological daughter, who is now age 24. Now, Mr. Salatin asked the question that others are asking openly, and many, many others beyond that are asking more quietly, and that is this: if homosexuality is okay, why is incest wrong? Now, in order to answer that question, Mr. Salatin goes back and reviews the case against incest. The legal arguments have been based in such arguments as genetics. After all, there is a greater likelihood of genetic abnormality with incestuous relationships. But as he says, there could be incestuous relationships that simply are not possibly reproductive. Then there is the traditional argument from consent, but there could certainly be the possibility of consensual sexual relationships that are incestuous. So where Mr. Salatin is left is with the legal theory of family damage, that incest is wrong because it tears apart the basic structure of the family, sundering relationships that are supposed to be non-sexual, and adding a sexual dynamic that is deeply destructive and injurious of the family. Now, he then raises a very interesting point. Here's his argument. Homosexuality simply does not fall under the same moral argument. In order to make that argument, Mr. Salatin has to identify family damage in terms of just one individual family, and even then to ignore the family of origin. His argument is that when two homosexuals get together, they're starting a family rather than severing a family. Well, that's an eccentric way to frame the question, but if you accept his premise, you're pretty much led to his conclusion. Now, what makes it really interesting in this article is that Mr. Salatin gets the liberal argument right. As he says, when liberals look at the arrest of David Epstein, they get very uncomfortable because their basic issue of consent says that there's no basic issue wrong with this. As he suggests, they may think that it's icky, but they have a hard time understanding why it's morally wrong. That is, why incest is wrong. On the other hand, he also gets the conservative argument right, pointing to all sexual abnormalities and sex outside of marriage as injurious to the family, not only in terms of the individual family unit, but the family as an institution. Now, in my article published today at albertmuller.com, I make the point that Christians must take the argument far further than where mere conservatives would leave it. We have to take the argument from mere wrongness to sinfulness and put it in the context of God's creation of human beings in His image as sexual creatures with a particular purpose, with marriage as the central institution of human civilization, and with the regulation of sexuality being not just a matter of do's and don'ts, but a matter of finding human flourishing within obedience to the Creator's command. Of course, Christians put the whole issue of sinfulness within the narrative of the gospel, that is, sin and redemption. So, when we're asked the question, why is incest wrong? Well, you better file this under questions for which you had better have an answer. If you didn't think it was a question being asked, you're not listening to what's going on in the contemporary cultural conversation. If not where you are right now, then you can count on it arriving quite soon. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmuller.com, where today you'll find another major article published entitled The Christian Worldview as Master Narrative, Creation. You can also follow my messages on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.